This presentation is entitled The Limits of Learning Design and was authored and spoken by Stephen Downs. It was part of an online debate between Stephen Downs and Diana Lorillard called To What Extent Should Learning Design Be Supported Computationally? Put on by the Association for Learning Technology on the 23rd of February, 2012. I am ready, and if you could indicate in the chat room whether you're listening to me, I'd appreciate that. I think, based on my work, you can conclude with me that there's no argument that I support the use of technology to support learning and, of course, technology to support the development of learning. So the basis of my comments certainly are not going to be along the lines of no such system should ever be built. What's important, I think, and this is the perspective I'll be discussing this topic from, is to understand the nature of such systems and what their limits are and what we're bringing to these systems and what the users are bringing to these systems. And hence, I'm talking about the limits of, quote unquote, learning design. Well, when I think of learning design, I typically think of IMS learning design because that's the most, fully developed framework. But I think pretty clearly that we can talk about learning design along many contexts. We see design patterns, pedagogical patterns, etc. When I think of learning design, I think of it as the concept of patterns, whether they be designed specifically or models or rules, or principles in general, which are abstract representations of something concrete. And in this case, they are in some way abstract representations of the learning process itself. Now, we want to think about what's happening when we're creating abstractions. Most people think of abstractions along the model of the picture at the left there. This crow is black, therefore all crows are black. And that's how it's been characterized in philosophy for many years. John Stuart Mill talked about universal laws being summaries of the observations we've seen in the past, the inductive method, as Jeremy Knox is saying in the chat room. But in fact, abstractions are created not by extrapolation, but through a process of subtraction. We get an abstract sentence, an X is a Y, by subtracting elements from the sentence. And all language abstracts in this way. And in fact, language is fundamentally a process of abstracting in this way. The elements of a language are whatever is left over after the abstraction. If we look at the example, an X is a Y, the elements of the language here are the words an and is. The grammar or the syntax of the language is going to be the set of rules for manipulating that language. These two things are the fundamental elements, the fundamental components of any learning design. Now, we need to be clear about what's happening with a language. A language has multiple purposes. A language has a purpose to describe or to communicate, to explain, to reason, to define, and many other things. I've explored that in another presentation called Speaking in Lolcats. And it's really important, I think, to understand that all languages do all of these things. That you can't separate out these functions. You can't say, this language is just to describe, that language is just to explain. In the process of describing, you're explaining. In the process of explaining, you're defining, and so on. It's what George Lakoff talks about when he's talking about frames. The language, when the use of a language implicates you into an entire metaphysics, an entire understanding of the world, a worldview. This worldview is implicated by the elements of the language, the entities of a language, the words an and is in the example, and the rules for manipulating of that language. When you're talking about learning design, you have to understand that you're talking about a language and that you're representing something as a language. You can't talk about learning design and pretend that it's something else, because it is this abstraction that is being created by this process of subtraction, of taking out, as was described in the previous presentation, the concepts, which are interchangeable, taking those out, and then whatever is left. Well, whatever is left is a language. Learning design, whether it's a pattern language, a pedagogical language, or full IMS learning design, is a language. And it's kind of a pseudo-language, and you know, the different approaches are different ways of creating pseudo-languages. And there's a long history in computing, in translation, etc., in the construction of pseudo-languages. In computing science, we have a thing called pseudocode, which is just kind of a formalized English representation of what you want the computer to do, but not expressed in actual computer language. There's a thing called Globish that is being talked about in front of the International Standards Organization. And the proposal is to redefine English so that you remove all of the contextual elements out of it and leave yourself with a vocabulary of about 1,000 words and basic English sentences and principles. Sounds like Esperanto. Yeah, it's like Esperanto, except it's Esperantish or Globish. Languages are more or less abstract, and we can define this fairly precisely. We can say that they're more abstract if they have a smaller set of elements. We can say that they're more abstract if they have a smaller rule set or rule base. We can say that they're more abstract if they have greater expressibility. And you can almost think of different languages as being on a slider up and down the levels of abstraction. So you can have really, really concrete descriptive language, or you can have language that's expressed in more general terms, or you can start talking in X's and Y's, and you know, you can get to like really, really, really abstract language. In science, and therefore by implication in everything we do, right? There's this methodological principle. I underline that it's a methodological principle, although it has implications, to prefer pure abstraction, to prefer fewer elements, fewer principles. It's the principle of parsimony. It's the principle of Occam's razor. It's the idea that you want to express whatever it is you're trying to express in as general terms as possible, or in other words, by subtracting out as much that is concrete as possible from your sentences in the language. This methodological principle reduces us to different kinds of languages, the language of mathematics, which is based on counting, the language of sets and set theory, which is based on properties and grouping, the language of computability, which is based on Boolean algebra and is a process of moving and putting things in registers and really simple additions. And these languages have been found by people like Russell and Whitehead, Tarski, and others, to be essentially all aspects of the same language. And this is kind of important. It creates kind of a numerical foundationalism, and indeed even a numerical mathematical set theoretical reductionism. But we need to understand it's a methodological principle. We need to be careful because, again, languages, you think you're just describing, but you slide into explaining and defining in a hurry. And when you use a type of language that is that abstract, you move yourself into the tendency to think of the world as fundamentally a mathematical entity. That's neither here nor there. We're not here to debate whether or not the world is a mathematical entity. But I want to emphasize here that when you use a language, you don't just simply describe, you begin to impose a reality onto whatever it is that you're describing. And that reality is based on whatever elements remain in your language after you've abstracted out the stuff you want to abstract out. So here's that sliding scale that I talked about on the left-hand side, the concrete, the real world, and on the right-hand side, pure abstraction. And in the middle is something more or less kind of loosely defined as language. And what's really happening here is all of these things are happening at the same time. We have a real world, we have a pure abstraction, we have a language, and we're involved in this constant process of interpretation. Language to the real world. There's an interpretation process that happens here. How does what the words we say, what the sentences we express, relate to the real world? Language to pure abstraction. How are the rules and the principles of linguistic inference derived from or related to the principles of pure abstraction? In computer code as well, we can see this same sort of gradation. We go all the way from natural language and the as yet mythical natural language processing through to process-based, rule-based, and object-based systems, and those are in order, down to, you know, really ones and zeros, basic, pure, abstract, binary code. And in the middle there, you can sort of see a visual representation from the actual concrete instance of a crow to a statement about a crow to a statement about all crows to some stuff that we don't understand. Might be imposing a worldview by accident. Exactly, John. This brings us to the reusability paradox, and the reusability paradox, commonly attributed to David Wiley, is just a question of how we're moving up and down this line of abstraction. If we look at the middle of that line where language is, imagine that language could move more toward practice or more toward theory. The more it moves toward practice, the more directly it relates to practice, but the less abstract it becomes, the less reusable it becomes. On the other hand, the more language moves toward theory, the more abstract it comes, the more reusable it comes, but the further away from practice it is. When it's far away from practice or far away from theory, that puts a load on the interpretive task. That creates the need for an interpretation. And that's where, if you will, the magic kind of happens. So, to take all this and relate it specifically to learning design, the key question for learning design, the key question is there a functionally useful language that describes teaching and learning? Rod, I'm in the middle of a presentation right now. I'll call you back. Thank you. Sorry about that. I just hung up on my supervisor. In the middle of a presentation. That's a first. So, is there a functionally useful language that describes teaching, that describes learning, that describes the stuff related to teaching and learning? Well, here's the thing. If there is such a language, and it can be directly interpreted in a formal way, because we are talking about computational languages, then we can just use computers to teach. There's no need for interpretation, right? But if there's not such a language, then there's this gap that's created, the interpretation gap, and at certain point, we need teachers. But also, at these specific points, the interpretive gap, learning design becomes meaningless. And it's in these interpretive gap that we're bringing in or importing all of these worldviews. So, let's look at learning design language, just generically, without looking at a specific one. What are the elements of that language? What's the syntax of that language? What will ground or give meaning to those elements? What is the interpretation of that language? Well, what are the primitives? This is the first question we ask. What are the primitives of a learning design language? What are these primitives? What are their roles? What are the interpretations? Again, we don't get away with not having interpretations. Take something like probability, for example. We can have all the probability calculus in the world, and probability calculus works the same way mathematically for everyone, but when we try to go from probability calculus to sentences to things about the world, the interpretations come in. With probability specifically, for example, you have the logical interpretation of probability, Rudolf Carnap, for example. Rudolf Carnap says, consider all possible states of the world, pull out the subset of those that represents what you're trying to figure out, and that's probability. On the other hand, people like Heinz Reichenbach use the frequency theory of probability, and that is, instead of looking at all possible states, just count all the states that have existed in the past, count the subset of those that represents what you're looking for, that's the probability. Or then there's Frank Ramsey, who says the probability is based on how much you would bet. If you would bet $50 to earn $100, then that's the probability. If you'd only bet $1 to earn $100, then that's the probability. David Newman is saying patterns not the same as formal language. Quite right. We'll come back to that. So, let's look at learning design specifically. Let's look at what the assumptions are that are brought in by learning design. Thinking about, for example, processes. When we import a learning design, whether it's the pedagogical patterns that we've been looking at, whether it's the use of timelines, and allocating time, I found that a very interesting set of presumptions there, or whether it's the flow described by IMS learning design, we're locked into some sort of model, some sort of process. Typically, these processes are more along the lines of flowchart processes. Very simple. Do this, then do this, then do this. If this, then do that. If this, then do that. There are other kinds of processes that we want to pull out. And I haven't seen any of these learning designs or patterns able to abstract on these processes. For example, rule-based processes. Instead of describing a flow or a sequence of activity, a rule-based process provides you with a list of conditions. And if the conditions are triggered, then the actions are triggered. This is known as list processing. Another way of thinking about processes is to think of object event-based processes, where you don't even have a list of rules. Each object contains its own internal set of rules and its own way of interacting with other objects in the world, whether it's objects that it contains, whether it's objects in which it's contained, etc. And this creates a very different kind of process. Think about directionality. What sort of directionality is built in to the pattern language, built into the pedagogical language? Typically, we're looking at learning design as embodying some sort of learning objectives. But there are many other ways of describing objectives, problem solving, discovery. There are many other ways of describing the objectives of learning itself. For example, the development of capacities as opposed to the development of knowledge. Or there might not be any directionality at all. But again, I have yet to see a learning design or design pattern that can abstract out the presumptions that are built in with respect to directionality. We're locked into roles and entities. I was looking at Diana Lorillard's conversational framework, and we've got teachers, students, and other students, and those are the roles. And if you're using that conversational framework, you're pretty much locked into those sorts of roles. But we want a mechanism that allows us to unlock ourselves into the role, out of the roles. I did a paper recently that looked at roles of the educator and came up with 36 or so when counting different roles. And you know, when you invoke something like the teacher role, you're embedding so much stuff into that that it becomes almost meaningless. Epistemology, what's grounding your theories? What is the basis for meaning in the theory? Again, this is a major aspect of interpretation because it's going to tell us what rules are valid rules, what rules are not valid rules. Typically, our theories are based on theories of truth or reference. Snow is white in the theory, if and only if snow is white in the real world. But there are other ways of creating meaning and reference within a theory, And these create very different theories, very different rules. For example, coherence or webs of belief, as Quine talks about, or even Schopenhauer's world as will and representation. And it's interesting, I actually see that sort of approach to meaning and truth quite a bit more often than you might suspect. You know, there's a hidden positivism in a lot of these theories and in learning design generally. Positivism isn't simply, or isn't, I think, accurately characterized as reductionism, and reductionism into facts, reductionism into numbers, although it very typically is. Positivism is saying there is some standard of reference external to our theory that's going to hold our theory to truth. And it's a positivist theory, no matter what that external standard is, whether it's the real world, whether it's the principles of mathematics, or whether it's the major existing pedagogical theories. And for basing our learning design system on the major existing pedagogical theories, then we're importing this kind of positivist approach and this kind of theory of truth of theories into our theory. Most people are positivist. And as the slide says, it takes real guts to be a coherentist or a relativist. It takes a little something special to sort of free yourself from that positivism. In general, as a methodological principle, people want to build an interpretation, or you don't want to build the interpretation into the language. In general, when people are building languages, they want to keep, if you will, the language stupid and put the semantics at the edges. And in other words, what that means is you want the language to be as wide as possible, but you don't want to incorporate facts of the world into your language. And, you know, there's a general principle of network neutrality that people talk about on the internet, where, you know, you don't want internet service providers to impose their values, impose censorship regimes, impose preferential selection, etc., on the internet. And the same kind of preference holds for languages, where you want the language to be as theory neutral as possible. But the flip side of it, of course, is there is no theory neutral language. There is no such thing. But we can get some direction toward it. Through the rules of inference, through formal syllogisms, through the principles of computability and decidability, we can move from ones and zeros in the direction of the language. And it's sort of like starting from that pure formalist starting point. And that's what, as I said earlier, set theory and mathematics are based on this underlying pure formalism. From these, we build things like the principles of computation, the principles of predicate calculus, which is fundamental logical, if this, then that, etc. The theory is, out of this are built language, out of this are built design. But, you know, it's a big jump to go from these basic formalisms to language to design. But the main question I would pose here is, are language and design the only things that we can build on top of this purely abstract formalism? And the answer is no. Just as I've represented here two choices, there's no limitation in the number of choices that we have. You know, the very act of using a language to bridge this formalism with the real world itself brings in some sort of statement about the nature of the world and some sort of statement about the nature of understanding cognition, that it is language-based, that it is designed-based, that it is model-based. And that's an assumption that we need to question. Cognitivist theories, in general, are those theories where pure abstraction is based on the pure element of thoughts, which are then mapped into some kind of language or representation that will be used to express abstractions. It's called the theory in philosophical terms. In contrast to that, of course, we have the non-theory theory. Here's the other version of the same framework, where when we have the real world, which is our black crow, just like before, but instead of numbers, mathematics, instead of formal languages, set theory, etc., we have something I'm simply characterizing here as human. Now, it's still the same sort of abstract, formal, on one side, real, practical, practice-based on the other side. But instead, our slider is moving to a different kind of formalism. Now, arguably, this kind of formalism may well reduce to the ones and zeros of pure formalism, and that is the topic of graph theory. And there's a good argument to say that it does. My point is, instead of going pure numbers to language, we can go pure numbers to human, to real world. So we're talking about close to the time limit. Yeah, and I'm almost done. I'm so close to done. So the non-theory-based theory is one where we talk about the elements of the world being connections, where we talk about the fundamentals of human thought being connections, where we say that humans are fundamentally connective entities and not cognitive entities. That this whole business of language and interpretation, which is at the core of the concept of learning design, is something that we're going to skip. Instead of talking about the line from the real world through an interpretation, through a language, through an interpretation to whatever, we talked about going from the real world through a process of pattern recognition to the human representation, which is, as I say, the network. It's a type of direct perception. It's not mediated with a representation. It's not mediated with a language. Now, we use language to talk about learning. We use language to describe learning. Languages has its uses, just like content management systems have their uses. But we need to be careful not to confuse the language with the learning process. We need to be careful not to import into our description of the learning process these presumptions. Presumptions about how much time it takes, presumptions about the sequence of activities, presumptions about the nature of truth, the type of process. We need to be careful about all of those. Now, it does raise questions, and people do ask questions, how do people learn this? How do you get people to know that? And, you know, it does take courage to work in this non-representational kind of way. But, in fact, what learning is on this model is a type of pattern recognition. And learning is not about remembering a set of facts or theories as based in a language or a representation. Teaching somebody to teach isn't about teaching them a bunch of patterns. It isn't about teaching them a bunch of theories, a bunch of representations. It's about teaching them to be a good pattern recognizer. And being a good pattern recognizer is going to be based, and I have a long talk about that, on the principles of effective networks. It's like direct perception. It's like the way we learn a language. We don't learn a language by learning some other language in order to learn the language, because then we're off to a reductio, right? Because we need some other language to learn the other language to learn the language. But then we'd need some other language to learn the other language to learn the language to learn the language, and so on. When we learn French, what we're trying to do is perceive directly in French. When we learn physics, what we're trying to do is perceive physics directly as physics, etc. That's my last slide. That's the basis of my comments and my objections to learning design.